Hi, everyone. It's Janice, host of the Divorcing Religion podcast. Thanks for tuning into my show, whether you're joining me on audio or video. I've heard from some folks recently who have told me just how much the show has meant, and some of them have even found it not only to be life-changing, but life-saving, as they felt there was no one else who understood what they were going through, and they found the Divorcing Religion podcast, and they started feeling encouraged. Please help me keep my show on the air. Become a member by clicking the join button on the Conference on Religious Trauma YouTube channel. Thanks. Bye-bye. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Divorcing Religion podcast. I'm your host, Janice Selby. Today is part two of my interview with Hannah Abbasi. My guest today is Hannah, and we are both fellows in the Borgenknecht Fellowship through the Rights and Religions Forum. The fellowship supports advocates and activists helping people who have left insular religious groups. In last week's episode, Hannah was telling us how she had been raised in a Pentecostal home in the United States and then had a dramatic conversion to Islam facilitated through Muslim relatives in the United States Kingdom. So that was quite an exciting and interesting episode. And today she is joining us to tell how she went then from Islam into more of a secular humanist situation that she's in today. And it led her actually to become one of the founders of Annas, which is an ethics-based community for humanists from Muslim backgrounds. So I'm very excited to hear the rest of your story. Welcome back, Hannah.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back. Nice to see you again. And I hope everyone has listened to the first podcast, because if not, it's not everything's going to make sense. So So I guess I'll jump right into it. So last time I was talking about when I was in college and I had started to meet Shia Muslims. And for anyone from a Muslim background, they're probably aware of the different groups in Islam. So so I was a Salafi Muslim, which is, to sum up from last time, basically like the most extreme version of a Sunni Muslim that you find. And they're the type that is like funded by the Saudi government or had been historically for a while. It's that sort of philosophy and perspective on Islam that is propagated through Saudi specifically. So I had met, I'll skip that. So I'm assuming everyone listened. And then moving into like, that's the kind of perspective I was going into when I was going into college. So this was also the time period where chat rooms were a big thing. And I lived in Texas where there weren't a lot of Muslims, in an area of town that there weren't a lot of Muslims. So I was the only Muslim at my school, at my high school. And I didn't have a lot of exposure. So I found community online. And it was there that I first started encountering Shia Muslims. And so that's kind of where I first started to question a little bit the Salafi teachings, basically, of that Shia Muslims are not considered Muslim. And last time I also brought up the issue of giving salams, like saying salams to other Muslims when you greet or leave each other. And that's going to become relevant. So part of that, I guess, just to recap that when Muslims see each other, when they greet each other, they say assalamu alaikum to each other. And the response is wa alaikum assalam. And sometimes it's short to salam, wa salam, like that sort of thing. But if it's basically, it's sinful to not give the salams to another Muslim or to like withhold it. Or so if a Muslim says to you, assalamu alaikum, you have to reply. It's considered a sin or like a minor sin to not respond. Because when you're not responding, you're basically not acknowledging their belief. You're saying that they're not Muslim, that they don't deserve your response. That's wow. Essentially what that means, to deliberately withhold a response. So sorry, that's about to become more relevant. So so then I went into college. I was still Salafi. I was wearing the niqab. At the time, I was the only young woman on campus wearing one of like 45,000 students. And so I stood out a lot. And I was also in this period of time where, trends change. And as when I went into college, I was wearing all black, like the very Saudi style. But then I started to be, I think that's where I started to be more open-minded, like, oh, like I can cover up, but maybe this isn't the way to do it exactly. So I started wearing more color, more designs. Like I was still covering everything, but I started steering away from all black. I do think black is one of my comfort colors. It's a color that I've always liked to wear, so it was easy. But so I started to be a little more open-minded, so I didn't stand out in such a negative way. Because I also saw it as like wearing the niqab, I didn't feel I was doing it out of religious obligation. I was doing it out of, there was a lot to it, but a lot of it came to identity, deciding that I embraced this new part of me and this decision. And so I was like going all in. In some ways, it was also very much a political statement. But even when it stopped being a political statement, it was a lot more of like who I felt I was. Like I really identified with that part of covering. And with that, I did. Okay, so now when I'm on when I'm on campus, it was a very large university. I went to the UT Austin, and there is there's like a shuttle bus that goes through the areas around campus and through campus, like take people around. And that first semester, I kept on ending up on the same bus with this guy, this very obviously Muslim guy. He was wearing a kufi, which is like a little hat similar to like Jewish people wear, but bigger. And he had a beard, and I really like beards. That's like my thing. like if you look at every ex I've ever had, they've all had a beard. And so he had a beard, and we just kind of started to notice each other. Like I think the first time he saw me, it was kind of crowded on the bus, and he gave up his seat for me to sit there. And then I felt like very shy because there was this guy speaking to me, and I had already become very, I was mostly around a lot of women. All my friends were women at this point, once I got into college for the most part. So that turned into, apparently my roommates went to high school with him and were friends with his roommates. And we ended up like, apparently he was asking around about me. And there's like, we went to like some MSA meetings, and my roommates come up to me and they're like, oh, there's this guy who wants to talk to you. And I'm like, astaghfirullah, which means like, seek repentance from God. Like, oh, that's sinful. Like, what's he trying to do? Talk to me, you know? And they're like, no, he's really nice. Like, you should talk to him. And then I'm still thinking about like, oh, this guy I saw on the bus. And I'm like, no, I'm not interested. And then they point him out, and it's that guy. Like, he's at the MSA meeting, which is the Muslim Student Association meeting. And I started talking to him, and then I find out he's Shia. And when we say talking, Muslims do this a lot when they're young. Like, talking is like, a very innocent form of like dating. Like you just start literally talking to each other, but you're not usually alone in any sort of context. And then I find out who's Shia, and I'm like, oh, like he's like a kafir. Like he's not even Muslim. Like why would I want to talk to him? And then he kind of challenges me on something I said. I didn't say that bluntly to his face, that I didn't think he was Muslim, but he got the sense that that's how I felt. And he said, I don't remember now what he said, but he challenged me on like what I was thinking. And then I started to be more curious about what he said. And then there was a long period of time where I didn't talk to him at all. And he was actually pretty persistent. So like he kind of kept coming in the picture, and we would run into each other because it's really like, there's a lot of people, but the campus is actually not that small or like not that big. Right. And we lived near each other. We were on the same route for the bus. And we also go to the same events and all of that. And his friends, you know, were friends with my friends, and so we were just in that same circle. So I continued to kind of speak to him, but more like I started religiously debating with him. And then this opened the door to me starting to like learn more, like actually wanting to study, because I think in that situation, he challenged me to question what I had just accepted as like doctrine, as 100% correct, as the truth. And when I had went from, you know, when I was a Christian, that was something that like I challenged ideas that didn't make sense to me logically. And those were more philosophical. There's not a lot of history related to like, how can you prove the Trinity with history? It's a philosophical debate at the end of the day. The idea of original sin and all of that, these are beliefs, not really concrete facts that you can prove. And so I think this started this period of time where I started to debate with this perspective of like evidence and proof and things, concrete evidence. And it was during that time, I mean, this was a while ago, so I'm trying to like remember how everything went down. Anyway, so he brought up some different issues. And last time I mentioned the age of Aisha as being something that actually really mattered to me. And it's because with Sunni Muslims, it is generally accepted. Most Sunni Muslims are going to tell you Aisha was 6 when she got married and 9 when she consummated the marriage. But among Shia Muslims, it's disputed, and the general consensus is that she was 16 when she got married and 19 when she consummated. And this isn't even around the idea of child marriage. It's not even like trying to avoid that. It's literally what's in text from hundreds of years ago, what's in the text and debating about the authenticity of that text. And so when I went back to my, let's call him my mentor, the person who led me into Islam and into embracing Salafi Islam specifically, when I went back to him, I sent him we were emailing sometimes and chatting sometimes on AIM or it was like a Hotmail. What was it? MSN Messenger. I think that's what I used to use after AIM wasn't really a thing. So we would chat sometimes, and it was very much religion based at that point. And it would just be for questions. And that's when I started to question about the age of Aisha. And I'm like, I'm coming up with different evidence. And I don't want to spend too long going into this, because the science of hadith, that's called Ilm al-Hadith, is very complex. So I don't want to spend too much time on that. But I'm struggling with how to explain this without going into too many tiny details. So it's essentially, he says, these hadith that you're seeing, these Sunni hadith that you're seeing disputing the age of Aisha, there's merit to them, is essentially what he said. And then he says, but it's not a big deal. You shouldn't be so focused on this. And I think hearing that, it kind of, internally, I flash back to when I'm 12 and I'm questioning Christianity and I'm being told, just accept it. It's faith. And you don't have to, don't nitpick, because that's where Shaitan, Satan, comes in and makes you doubt yourself. But for me, it's if this is the word of God and this is the truth, the solid truth of the world, of the universe, then no matter how much you nitpick, you'll never find flaws. Because if there is this God who's created everything, there can never be a mistake. Because if he created our bodies, which are so complex, and everything in the entire world, how could there be any tiny mistake in some text, some book? How could that possibly exist? And so what this did was, it didn't just break my disillusionment and my enchantment with Salafi Islam. It broke something deeper inside, where I never felt that 100% confidence in religious texts anymore, or in anything I was being told. I think that was really the door that led me to okay, I already felt I was a critical thinker, but this led me to be someone who was constantly aware of anything people would say in terms of belief, and being able to okay, if you believe something, we should be able to back it up and prove it. It shouldn't just be we believe this because we believe it. That's not good enough. It wasn't good enough anymore. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts or questions so far?
And so you were about, pardon me, about 18 or 19 at this point, and you were in the United States. So you hadn't yet gone abroad to study Islam, or had you already gone and studied in some of the other Muslim countries? Yeah.
No, I hadn't gone yet. So,
okay.
Yeah. So what that timeline kind of looks like. Okay. So actually that leads to it. So I ended up becoming a Shia Muslim. But again, I didn't have that 100%, that 100% solid, I know this is always going to be the truth, because I didn't feel that, not because I doubted something. I felt at that point when I became Shia that, historically speaking and evidence-based speaking, it was the interpretation of Islam that made the most sense. And that the way the books, the hadith were collected, the way, basically the whole story of Shia Islam, it, from an outside perspective, it's often not shown very well, but I approached it with a historical lens and I felt it was the most accurate thing. And so I was all right, this is likely to be the most, this is where I should go forward. So that's the step I took. I became a Shia Muslim. And then I'll get into the seminaries, because I hadn't announced to my Salafi mosque that I, or any people in my life, that I'd become a Shia Muslim. But I started meeting and hanging around with some of the Shia on campus, like young women and young men that were on campus. And there's not as much, there are obviously gender divides with Shia Muslims, but not quite to the extent. And these are Ithna Ashari Shia Muslims, which are the main group, let's say. They're, because there's a lot of different Shia groups. There's Ismaili and Quora and like all this other stuff. But the Ethnocentry is the main group, we can just say.
Mm-hmm.
So I start hanging around with people, and then there, my best friend at the time, my very closest friend, was a woman I knew from the mosque, and she was actually a few years older than me. She had gotten married. She, you know, graduated college and immediately got married and moved to where her husband was. And he was in the same school I was in. I think he might've been doing his master's or something. He was a little bit older than me, but just by like a few years, she was still like low 20s, and she had a very sheltered upbringing. And so all my close friends at the mosque were women who wore niqab. Besides me and this other young woman, they all had kids. Many of them were converts as well, while their husbands weren't. And that wasn't always the case, but many of them would convert and then immediately get married. It's not like they were, it was kind of similar to my like situation with like Shia Muslims. Like usually it wasn't the man introducing it and then a woman converting for him. With Salafis, there's usually a lot more conviction that comes with it. If you're going to go that extreme, like, and Salafi men aren't usually out dating women who are not Muslim. It happens, obviously, but usually they're not doing that. Whereas you'll see like more cultural Muslims or people who are more lax on things. They might be out there dating. And then for the wedding, the new husband or wife will like say Shahada to like become Muslim. But with Salafis, it doesn't tend to be like that. It's like a lot of like American converts become Salafi specifically. Anyways, I'm spending so much time on this whole Salafi thing.
That's okay.
Where was I going from here? So they find out. So I didn't know all the men at the mosque knew who I was. I actually wasn't aware of that. Because I never spoke to any of the men at the mosque. I literally had no idea who they were. The Salafi mosque is very segregated. The men enter from one side of the building and the women enter from the other side of the building. We literally never see each other. But apparently they knew who I was. Like they all knew who I was. I didn't know that. And apparently one of the Salafi guys was best friends with my best friend's husband. And he saw me with some Shia people. I don't know. Also to note, I started taking Arabic classes my first semester in college, and the TA of that class was actually the sheikh at the Shia mosque in the city. And he was also a convert, but he had converted like decades ago. So he was much older. He'd gone back for his PhD in Arabic. He had previously studied in Iran. And so it wasn't just like this guy I saw on the bus. It was also, right. I found out my TA is Shia, and Arabic classes are like, they're like double, language classes tend to be like double per semester. So it's like taking two classes. So I was around him a lot. And so he started to, I think he started speaking to me in a way. I find out who he's Shia, and I started talking to him a little bit. And sometimes outside of class, we would just like sit and talk about religion. So a lot of my like initial knowledge actually came from him more than this guy who was pursuing me. But my debates were more with the guy who was my age. And then the TA, I would just like ask questions, and, you know, because I respected him as an elder as opposed to like the guy who was my age, who was like, you don't know more than me, like, you know, whatever kind of thing. I was seen on campus, and without talking to me or anything, without confronting me, I come into the mosque one Friday and I go and sit down next to my friend, and I'm like, oh, assalamu alaikum. Hey, you know, like blah, blah, blah. And she makes eye contacts with me, ignores my salam, and then just responds to the next thing I had said. And then I was like, what's going on? Like immediately, I was like, what's going on? You never do that. And she's like, what do you mean? I was like, why didn't you respond to my salam? And then and she's like, doesn't know what to do. Like, she's also a young person. And I'm like, okay. And then I like get up, and then I see one of the other women, and I go say salam to her, and she doesn't respond to my salam. And I was like, so I look at them and I'm like, what's going on? And then nobody will like really say anything. And they're like, well, one of them eventually says, oh, we heard you've been with the Shia Muslims on campus. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, well, you know, Shia aren't Muslims. And I was like, what do you assume? Like, I haven't told them anything. I was like, what are you assuming? And I'm like, why aren't you responding to my salam? And then they're just quiet. And so I'm like, okay, fine, whatever. And then I leave, I go out the door, and then my best friend follows me. And she's like, well, just tell us that you're not Shia. and it'll be okay. It'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why wouldn't you ask me that in the first place? Like, for one, if you think that I've become a Shia, like, why wouldn't you at least ask me? And then for two, like, you don't know anything about Shia Muslims. And she's like, well, explain it to me. And I'm like, I'm not going to stand here and like justify this right now. Like the way you guys are like doing that. Anyway, so that's kind of how it went down with the Salam situation. Then it wasn't obviously the end of the story. Later talked to them a little bit more. And she even said to me something like, I eventually said, I've become Shia. I did admit it later, but I was also very confused. Like, how did they even know this? Like, I don't know. Muslims talk. Like, people know everything. And I'm like, I have like two friends. Like, how does everyone know this? Like, anyway, and because I was a niqabi, I think that I was sort of I was like a token, you know, in a lot of ways. And I didn't even realize my position on campus and amongst like young women on campus and young Muslim women. I didn't even realize what was going on. I was just living my life. And that's sort of what happened. So, anyway, even like a month or so later, I meet with my friend and she even invites me over. She still won't return my salam. And I'm like, why can't we even be friends? Like, why can't you hear me out? And like, you know, I'm still Muslim. I just don't believe exactly the same things you. I'm still praying. Like almost everything is exactly the same. Like, it's not that different. I'm still wearing the niqab, like all of that. And she's like, you know, if you come back to being Sunni and, you know, you reject this stuff that you're doing, then yeah, we can be best friends again. And I'm like, well, like, so we can't even, I was like, you won't even talk to me? And she's like, no, because you're going to confuse me. I was like, what do you mean? She's like, well, if you ever, you're going to talk about your Shia stuff and I'm going to start to get confused and you're going to misguide me. I'm like, wow. Okay. So, and that's the Salafi perspective, right? Like instead of discussing, it's okay. I don't want to be misguided. I'm like, all right. So anyways.
Such fear.
Yeah. A lot of fear around that. A lot of fear around that. So moving on from that, I become Shia the rest of my college years. I'm very active in the Shia mosque and I've sort of left. I'm still very hurt about all my Salafi friends, like ditching me, and refusing to associate with me. That was very painful because I'd known them for a couple years at that point. And they were my first community too. So it was a painful experience. Mm-hmm. And that TA that I mentioned, I continued to like know him very well. I continued to like sit and, what was really cool about that dynamic, it was kind of a small mosque, comparatively. So all the Shias Ibn Ashari Shias within the city would actually all come there. So it was very diverse. There was, you know, we have our like Iranians, Pakistanis, the black converts, like Arabs of all different flavors. You got everyone there. They're all mixing together, which was really nice as a first experience. There was no like segregation and you get this whole spectrum of like barely practicing to like super religious in the same mosque. And it was cool that the TA would actually, who was the sheikh. So the sheikh would actually take us out, all the young people from campus on like Saturday nights, we'd have a program. We'd all go pray. He'd give a lecture, which, you know, so we'd give a lecture. We'd pray together. We'd have dinner, everyone together at the mosque, like the whole mosque. And then afterwards, like the young people would go out, we'd go get like coffee or desserts and we would just talk about religion together. And it kind of allowed me to like grow amongst both genders and really discuss. And during that time, I became very good friends with like more of the guys in the group. Of course, none of them had ever seen my face, but because we would sit and debate about religion, talk about religion. And then at the end of my college years, I decided to finish a semester early because the TA was like, hey, I know that I have this connection with this group who's leaving in December to do XYZ in Iran. And if you want to go and study there, I can get you in and I have a sponsor who will like take care of you when you get there. But to get the visa and to do all of this stuff, you'll have to leave with this group at the end of December. So I literally like graduated and a week later I was on a plane like to Iran.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. No, and you weren't, there was there fear or anxiety associated with it? Like, was this 10 years ago, 5 years ago?
Yeah, this was, so I would have been, I think, 21. So this was over like 12 years ago, I guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was just the end of 2011. So was when I graduated and I graduated semester early. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to Iran, It was, so I went to Qom, which is the city where the predominant, like most of the seminaries, there's like a few seminaries are located in that city. And I know that we don't have a lot of time, so I won't focus too much on the seminary experiences. But while I was there, first you have to learn Farsi, and then you can start taking more classes because the classes are held in Farsi. There were occasionally different things held in Arabic, and there weren't a lot of Americans or Westerners there. So I actually had to learn Farsi through Arabic, which was extra challenging.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a struggle for sure. But there was a small group of young women who were from Western countries, such as like Canada. There were some Americans, some Canadians, like there was a couple Germans. My new best friend was German. And yeah, I had an issue with picking best friends because we would love each other and have these really strong connections. But as soon as I changed my mind about something, it's like I was no one to them. The only thing apparently we would have in common was our devotion to whatever faith we were a part of.
That's so painful.
At least that was, yeah, it was very painful. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I was there for a few months and I think I had already started to doubt religion. At this point, I was in an all-women seminary, which was like a closed campus. And it wasn't as simple as like, we had a curfew. It's that we literally weren't allowed to leave without permission. And we were allowed on like excursions, like once or twice a week, where they'd take us to go grocery shopping or something. And if we didn't want to do grocery shopping, we could pay to like eat in the cafeteria, which was super cheap. It wasn't very expensive. And I did have sponsorship, like people from the mosque back home, like gave me money to like do this. And everyone wants to encourage like young people to do this kind of stuff because it's not like it's a life of like financial security. It's a life for God. I'm basically going to live in a monastery, but the Shia Muslim version. So anyway, so while I was there, I started to have some doubts. I stopped wearing niqab because it became, in Iran, niqab is seen more about as a cultural thing, as an Arab thing, as opposed to a religious thing. In many ways, there are plenty of Muslim women who wear niqab anyway, but it's less about being super Muslim and more about cultural stuff in many senses. So I didn't feel like I identified that with that anymore in that context. So I stopped wearing it.
Was it hard to make that change?
It was initially, yeah. and I remember even the first time, because I mentioned the seminary was like an enclosed space. So there was the school and connected to it was the dormitories. And within the dorms, there was like the center area that was fully open. It was like this open outdoor space. And and there was no men ever allowed in this area. Even like the people who come in and clean or fix stuff were women. No men at all. So we could all just walk around like with our hair out. And I remember the first time, like this was, how many years had it been? The first time that I had been outside with the sun on my face and feeling the wind through my hair. And it was a core memory that has like still within me, that the feeling of like every, like the wind touching me and the light breeze. And it just, I think it like awoke something in me, to be honest. And that was after how many years, like 6 years of covering completely. It was an experience for sure.
Yeah.
But to go in to speed up a little bit, everyone there treated me very well. There's a lot of fear, I think, around Iran and Iranians, but interestingly enough, Iranians are very good at separating people from government. And I think it's because of their own struggles that, you know, there was a revolution there, they overthrew their own government. And so people don't see Americans as the American government. There's a very big distinction. And so when they say things like death to America, they're talking about the American government, not to as Americans.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah. And it was very interesting because I actually was a little scared because I wasn't sure. The Iranians that I was friends with in college and in the mosque, they were totally fine, but they're also in America. Like, so how am I supposed to know how they feel? But there, what was interesting is like, remember I mentioned these excursions, we would go out, we do grocery shopping, and there was the... basically a very large mosque and shrine that was nearby. They would go to like once a week, all the young women who wanted to would go. And when I would go there and I'd be talking, it just strangers like in the women, there's like the women's side, obviously. And on the women's side, like just strangers would be around and they would come up and they'd want to touch me, like not hug me. They want to like pet me or like smell me. It was really weird. There was like a lot of like really weird instances where they were like fascinated, like I was like a zoo exhibit, which again made me feel very uncomfortable and weird. Mm-hmm. But it was, yeah, it was like it was a zoo exhibit because there weren't very many Americans in the school. There were only a few. And then there was like Canadians and a couple British people. And the one there were like, oh, you'll get used to it. I'm like, how do you get used to this? This is so weird. But it was, yeah, there was plenty of obviously very normal Iranians who were not trying to pet me or anything, but they were still fascinated with American life and,
sure,
and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So I started to actually question what I was doing with my life at this point. And I started to have like, there were doubts creeping in and I don't know why those doubts came up. And I think it was that it was like this period of time where I was away from everyone I had ever known. And I could sort of like whoever they knew was literally whoever I was telling them I was. So none of them knew niqab was this huge part of my identity. A lot of them also wore it when we would go out into the streets, even if they didn't normally wear niqab. And like when we would leave the school, because we were known to be like the Hausa girls. Hausa is like a seminary. So sometimes when we'd go outside of the school, they would wear a niqab too, or to not be noticed if they were more light-skinned or dark-skinned and like obviously not Iranian. So it was more of a convenience factor than it was religion or identity. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it was just a very different situation altogether. And so where was I going with that? Oh, okay. So I think that I started to allow myself to doubt in general. And maybe at the age of like 19, I wasn't ready to doubt the basis of religion. But now at like 21, I had, and living in this new country, I had a little more freedom to like figure out myself without the pressure of everyone's expectations on me. And I realized that I had felt like I was in this fishbowl for a very long time about, you know, being in the Qabi, being very religious, being probably the only person on campus who went from Sunni to Shia while there. I was a controversial person and I wasn't trying to be, I was just trying to like figure myself out. Mm-hmm. And being in Iran actually allowed me more time to think and that space. And after a few months, I was like, I don't actually want this. I don't want to stay here and study and then just marry some guy and live in Iran for the rest of my life. So I started looking for jobs in New York and I was applying through AmeriCorps Vista. And so I got a job. I applied to like 30 jobs. I got a few interviews. I got the job and then I was like, okay, I'm leaving. So I was there about 7 months or I think 7 months, somewhere between 6 and 8 months. And then I flew back to Texas for another time. Maybe I have all these stories about, I have some stories about the FBI and them trying to like figure out where I was and that kind of stuff.
That sounds very interesting. I invite you to take as much time as you would like. I don't have anything planned immediately after this, so go for it.
I'll just give a few brief ones. Sure. Okay, so for everyone who's watched episode one, basically they know that on my white side, I have an older sister. She's about 9 years older. And I didn't go into this a lot when we were talking last time because there's just so much to say about one's life. But she's always been a person who would defend me. So she would never let anyone else attack me. But then when it's just us, it's kind of like, why do you have to wear that thing? Can't you just take that off? Like the feelings of embarrassment, like the criticism. And she's thinking as a big sister, she's, you know, helping me or guiding me, but it isn't like that, right? Like not when you're in it. So one of the things was she was very ignorant of what Muslims went through in America, especially considering this is just like 10 years after 9/11. I do think things have improved since in the decade since that. Good. But this was still just like a decade before. And so there was and it was Texas. So it's not like an area with a whole bunch of Muslims to break stereotypes, right? And as someone in Texas, I was a representative of my entire religion of millions of people because no one else really knew anything about Muslims or had exposure to them. So the thing about the FBI, apparently while I was there, no, I had just come back. So I guess they monitor very closely. And also I've had issues before where my phone was being tapped when I was younger and I was like speaking to my mentor who like lived in Saudi. It was very obvious that my phone was being tapped for a good like year or so.
Wow.
Yeah. So that there's that. But then what happened when I came back, I started up a new phone plan, because when I went to Iran, I thought I was leaving. I thought I was moving there, at least for a while, like at least a few years. I didn't think I'd be coming back in like 7 months. And so I come back and I remember I had like taken my nephews out somewhere. They were pretty young at the time. They were like maybe 11 and 12 or 12, 13, something. And I took them to the park or something. And so I was staying with my sister when I had come back, and she calls me and she's like, "Hey, somebody just stopped by. And, I gave him your number." Oh wait, no, hold on. Let me think. This happens before she calls me to say what happened, or before I talk to her. Yeah. Sorry. Forgetting for a second. So I'm at the park with my nephews, and, we're out, like, they were like Boy Scouts, so we're like foraging or something. They're like showing off their new skills. And I get a phone call from a number I don't know. And this is back before we get all these spam calls from China. So I answer the phone and it's this guy from the FBI. And he starts interrogating me on the phone. And I got really scared because I'm still like, I'm like 22 or about to be 22 at this point. And I don't know what's going on. And especially at that point, like, there's a lot of fear in the Muslim community around the FBI. This was the period where like Guantanamo Bay was going strong. Like, this was, it was scary. Like, I was scared. Like, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know.
I'd be scared.
Yeah.
It's scary.
And he's asking me about like a whole bunch of stuff. And so I get off the phone. And he also asked me about when I'm going to New York. So he knows I'm going to New York. And he's like, "Well," and he's doing it in a way like, now I know that there's techniques to like interrogating people, like the way you ask, how quickly you ask. And then when someone's like young and scared, they're just going to respond with the truth. Right. And then, he asked me like, "Well, why are you going to New York?" And I was like, "If you know I'm going to New York, don't you know why I'm going to New York? Like, don't you know I have a job with the federal government? Like, AmeriCorps Vista is a part of the federal government. It's a funded volunteer program." And he's like, "Okay." And somehow we get off the phone. And the first thing I do is I call my sheikh. And I'm like, "I just got a call from the FBI. And I'm like, I don't know what to do." And he's like, "Okay, talk me through what happened." And he's like, "You didn't do anything wrong." He reassures me. He's like, "You're fine. If you want, I can reach out to so-and-so who can talk to you about like the situation." And he's like, "But you're okay. Like, you haven't done anything wrong. You told him you were honest. Like, there's, you know," and he's like, "Don't worry about it, but I'll have like somebody talk to you." So he arranged for me to speak to like a lawyer in the mosque who just kind of reassured me that I didn't do anything wrong. Nothing's going to happen to me. Although I didn't feel that security because Guantanamo Bay, and we're like always talking about it at that point in time. And I'm like afraid that they're going to send me there for going to Iran, you know? So I don't know. I was scared. Scary. So anyway, so I eventually talked to my sister. I think that this was on the phone. So I eventually talked to her and I was like, "I just got a call from the FBI and it was really scary and this and that." And she's like, "Oh yeah, they stopped by earlier." And I was like, "What do you mean?" And she's like, he came by. He asked me about you. He asked me where you've been. She just like opened up and told him everything about my whole life. All of the questions, all the friendly and everything. Invited him in for water and like lemonade or something. And I was just like, "What?" I was like, "Why?" I felt betrayed. And she had no idea that this was even a problem. And I was just like, "How could you do that? Like, why would you talk to them about me? Why would you give them my phone number? Like, why you like handed it to them?" And she's like, "Oh, I didn't know that this was a big deal. Like, I didn't know he was going to be rude to you or interrogate you." And I'm like, "This is the FBI. Why would he not do that? Like, this is what they do." And she's like, "Oh, I didn't know." Like, she was just completely ignorant about the situation. So it wasn't out of malice. It was her being a white Christian American who has never had a negative encounter with law enforcement, like, except for maybe a speeding ticket. And at that point, she hadn't even had a speeding ticket because she didn't drive or didn't drive very much. So yeah. Anyway, so to get back on track, So much.
That's okay. So you came back and then you were going to work for AmeriCorps or this. Yeah, I can't remember what it's called. That's right.
Yeah. So So I stayed with my sister for the summer. I saw some of my old friends from college. Thanks.
Were you still wearing the niqab?
No, I had taken it off and I decided not to put it back on. Okay. Yeah.
So but you were still wearing.
Abaya is like the long thing. When I came back, I transitioned to long sleeve shirts and skirts. And I think that I don't even know exactly. I don't remember why at this point, why I made that change, but I remember it being a very deliberate choice. I think a lot of you know, like I mentioned earlier about identity, a lot of my identity while I was in Texas was surrounded this idea of wearing niqab and an abaya, and that's who I was as a Muslim. And I think at that point, it didn't need to be part of my identity anymore. It was what it was. And it didn't feel like such a big deal to not do it. So when I came back, though, it was sort of a shock to everyone who knew me, because now suddenly everyone sees my face. And the girls were fine. They knew what my face looked like. But the boy with the young men, it was weird. It was kind of weird. Some of them would even they would either stare at my face a lot, while we're talking, in an uncomfortable way, they're finally seeing something for the first time, or they would completely avoid looking at my face altogether. Like, it depended on who it was. So for some of them, it was super awkward. And then some of them were I hear your voice and I know who you are, but who are you kind of thing when they would see me. So it was an interesting transition, but it's also very brief. I only was around them a few times, and then I had to leave for New York. And then with AmeriCorps, they bring everyone to do a training, and then you go to your hub city. So I went to New York, and again, I'm very community oriented. And that's where I started looking for community. New York City is a big place. And at the time I got the job. So my job was in the Bronx near Fordham University, and I was living in upper Manhattan. So I would just take the bus across, or after a few months, I would take the subway to the bus and go there. And I don't know how I found it, but I think I just started looking up Muslims in New York. I don't know. I didn't go to a mosque. What I did was I found at NYU, it's called the Islamic Center, and it's kind of their version of the MSA, but it's open to the public. It's not restricted to just students. And I was still the age of students, right? So I was I had friends in college because I was in college. So I'm just going to go to that college and join all their groups. And so that's what I did. I went there, Ramadan started. I think at that point, Ramadan was maybe September. It was kind of early on after I got there. I got to New York, and I think within a month or so, maybe 2 months, Ramadan started. And again, very community oriented. So I was I need to be at the mosque every night. I got to go for dinner. I got to, meet people. It's just, I was a social little butterfly. So I went there, made lots of friends. The structure of it would be we'd meet, we'd come there, and they were pretty open-minded. They weren't the Salafi mosque I used to be part of, where there were some Shia there. It was mostly Sunnis, but there were some Shia there. And if you weren't a Sunni, no one cared, no one judged you or was rude to you or anything. It was just nice. Sort of oh, that's different, mm-hmm. But it was a predominantly the sheikh there was Sunni, but he was, again, very open-minded and very nice person. So where was I going with that? So I get there, start going to stuff during Ramadan. The structure is basically you arrive at the mosque, there is some kind of lecture happening or whatever. Then the sunsets, there's the breaking of the fast. For Sunnis, they'll usually pass around dates and stuff, and then you'll do the sunset prayers, which is called Maghrib. And for Shia Muslims, they break their fast after the sunset prayer. So it just depends on this is just some minor stuff. Anyways, you're allowed to break it before, but it's generally accepted that you wait until after. there's a little debate about that. Anyways, small little stuff. But after the breaking of the fast, sunset prayers, then there'd be a dinner. And this is food that's sponsored. Nobody has to pay. It's not even a potluck. They just have food. And usually the way this happens when I say sponsored is probably people with money are donating to feed people at Ramadan, during Ramadan. There's a lot of, last time I mentioned this, this good and bad, the sins and good deeds being weighed. So there's a lot of stuff out there about if you feed a hungry person during Ramadan who needs food, then there's so many rewards, you get so many sins wiped off and blah, blah, blah. So there's a lot of people who use, I like to call some of them Ramadan Muslims, who use Ramadan to be perfect Muslims and do all the extra prayers and donate lots of money and do lots of stuff. And then the rest of the year, they're just living their lives. And they're not worried about it because it gets wiped off during Ramadan, right? So you see a lot of that. The food is sponsored. People who have money are giving it to feed the people who don't have money. Lots of rewards. In heaven, they're going to be super rich, right? That's their idea anyway. And then afterwards, so after the dinner, we'd have the evening prayer. So there's time periods between the five daily prayers, and it's based on like where the moon and sun is in the sky, pretty much. And so based on that, we would pray the last prayer. And there's something called Tarawih, which is when every night during Ramadan, there'll be extra prayers. And during every prayer, you're reciting part of the Quran, and the person leading the prayer is reciting it out loud. So there's this idea that during Ramadan, like everyone, like every night of the month, they'll come and they do that. They do extra prayers, and they're literally standing in prayer for 2 to 3 hours per night while the person in the front is like reciting parts of the Quran during the prayer. So you're just literally standing there for hours, and then doing some motions and then standing again. And so, yeah. And then the last 10 nights of Ramadan are like a super big deal. And that's when people will even sleep in the mosque overnight to do extra prayers, and that it becomes like a big slumber party. So, that's kind of what it was. It's like a really nice communal activity though. Like it sounds kind of crazy and intense, but when you're doing it with other people, it feels really good. It feels amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what we would do. And then sometimes before, after Tarawih, or especially in the beginning of Ramadan, when it's not as big of a deal, then I just made friends and we would just like all go out to the area around campus. Like there's this, the village is just right next to like NYU campus. So we go out for like coffees or, you know, decaf coffee or hot cocoa. And we weren't drinking alcohol, but we, you know, snacks or whatever we wanted to do, pizza, burgers. We just go eat more food. Like that's what we would do. Many of, especially in the last part of Ramadan, we stay up until the morning prayer, just out, like hanging out, especially on weekends too, until 4 o'clock in the morning. And then like just doing all of our, like hanging out and doing stuff, go back to the Islamic center, do the morning prayer, and then go home and like sleep. So it was a really communal experience that feels mm-hmm. good. And during that time, I was meeting like even more people. And one of the things about like Salafi Muslims in particular, but also most very religious Muslims of any kind, is they don't listen to secular music or music of any kind. So when I became Muslim, I stopped listening to music. And this is a good like 6 years later, I think, that I still didn't listen to music. I had no idea who pop stars were. Like I didn't watch movies. I considered it a waste of my time and energy. Like I was all about religion constantly. Or being around people and making friends. So I didn't watch TV. I didn't watch movies, none of that. I didn't waste time with those things. And so I remember like talking to somebody that year, and we were out just like chatting, and he was talking about music. Anyway, it just kind of like opened my mind to like not being like seeing Muslims as not having to be 120% and then accepting various interpretations. And just slowly opening my mind to these things. Somehow this eventually led me to, I started being curious about like dating and stuff. And so I made like a dating profile. I don't remember exactly how all this happened, but it was like within that year that first year of being in New York, I met this Jewish guy, and this was like the second half of the year. And he was an Arab Jew. So he was an Ashkenazi, very interesting background. He's from Long Island, where a lot of Jews there have a lot of money. And so I started talking to this Jewish guy, and we were, yeah, there's a lot to say about, he was a very kind person. He was a very nice and kind person. And the way he practiced religion was similar in the way I practice religion. Like it wasn't in a super conventional, I'm going to listen to the sheikh and do everything they say 100%. It was a very much like, oh, in my spare time, I like to read religious books and analyze them and compare them to other books and then discuss them. He was that kind of version, but as a Jewish person. So he knew his religion in a way that I didn't see a lot of culturally Jewish people know their religion, which is similar to like a lot of cultural Muslims wouldn't know religion in the way I knew it. Like it was a very historical and evidence-based way of practicing religion. And it led to a series of like debates, and we would enjoy our time together, but we'd also discuss religion all the time. Like we were always talking about religion and comparing them to each other. And it was within that time that, so he became like, we did really have strong feelings for each other. We started to really appreciate each other. And I think eventually his goal came not just to educate me, but to convert me. And he eventually admitted that he wanted me to become Jewish so we could get married. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can't become Jewish for you. I don't believe that. And a lot of, so what our discussions did, instead of converting me to Judaism, it actually led to me questioning the foundation of Abrahamic faiths, period. Mm-hmm. And something I didn't mention, when I was in college, I was also a religious studies major. I don't remember if I mentioned that last time. But during, as a religious studies major, you have like a, there's certain basic classes you have to take. I had to take a class in like philosophy of religion, for example. That class that I took was focused on sacred space and pilgrimage. And in that class, I learned about all the main religions in the world and their sacred spaces and pilgrimages. And we like talked and discussed like what does sacred mean and what does it mean to different people. It's a very like philosophical perspective, which I don't really vibe with so much, but seeing the evidence within all the religions, it was interesting, right? It was, mm-hmm. it was very educational. And then there's like classes that you have to take, you have to take a class in like each major religion, in every like region of the world, you have to take a class. So there's like certain classes you have to take, and then you get a focus religion and you get a secondary religion. My focus religion was Islam. And then my secondary religion was Christianity. So most of my other classes were like history of, or strictly like based on that religion. So I took a lot of history of Christianity classes and Islam classes. Anyways, and so Judaism was sort of like in the back of my mind. And there's this Muslim way of explaining inconsistencies with the two first religions, right? So Judaism comes first, Christianity hops off of that, and then Islam comes third. And Islam obviously doesn't have the idea of Jesus as the Messiah and the Son of God. They see Jesus as a really important person. He's actually considered one of the top five prophets. Like he's a super big deal. And the other prophets, you know, from Judaism, like Moses, Abraham, etc. So Noah. So the top five are like Abraham, Moses, Noah, Muhammad, and Jesus. Those are the big five. So there's respect for Jesus, but not him as like the Son of God. And there, when I was like studying religion, we also studied like some of the classes. There's like so many things that I hop back and forth from. So sorry for me hopping back and forth. But in some classes, I learned a lot about like the pagan rituals that we got a lot of Christian holidays from. I'm sure a lot of people who study Christianity are aware of like many of the pagan traditions. And there's stuff like even the day Jesus was the day that Jesus is said to have been born or that his birth is commemorated is associated with the birth of a god in Zoroastrianism. And then there's a lot of actual, consistency, or there's a lot of overlap with Zoroastrian beliefs and Christianity. And I learned a lot of that in college. And as I started to learn about Judaism from this person who I did respect him, I saw him as my equal, but I respected everything he was teaching me from his side. And it was interesting because I started to see even more that, there were more inconsistencies that you can't really explain away very easily. And what Islam does to explain these inconsistencies is to say the books of the Jewish and Christian people were corrupted over time. And so if there's anything that's inconsistent, the Muslims got it right and they got it wrong because people use their books to control and as power tools. This is literally like in the text, like this is known and understood. Oh, this is why there's inconsistencies. But a lot of times those inconsistencies addressed Christianity, which is like the big one to compare Islam to. But when you look at the very foundation of all of it, which is Judaism, and in Judaism, they don't have this concept of a devil and of a hell. Mm-hmm. And learning that, like really learning that, especially from this guy, and then we'd talk back and forth about all of these, like, you know, where does this belief come from or why not this? And I think in his mind, he was like, oh, I'm helping her to learn about the truth, right? Mm-hmm. Like she accepts this other thing. But for me, I think it just made me realize all of these religions are just tools to like control people. And this is not an inconsistency you can explain away. The entire foundation of not having a Satan why does it not exist in Judaism? That's a big deal. That's like the foundation of Christianity and, or the New Testament and Islam. There has to be a heaven and hell. If there's no hell, where do all the bad people go?
That's it. Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah. And it was just like, I think something like that's when it really broke me. I was like, what is going on? Like, there's no belief in hell. Like, how can Muslims really, how can they explain that there is no way to explain this away in Islam? The fact that Jews don't believe, that Jewish books don't affirm the idea of hell and a Satan. And when I started to say this, I started to say a little bit to this guy I was seeing and started looking up. I was also in that time, I was in this group that was, this is a total tangent, but I had joined this group that was for like Palestinian and Israeli, sort of a dialogue group. And it was
nice.
In
New York City. Yes.
And I don't even know how I got accepted into the group. I guess I was persuasive enough, but everyone in the group was either Jewish or Palestinian. And so it was like this dialogue group, like 10 people, and we had to commit to coming to this group so that we could have really tough conversations. And I came to it, obviously, like the pro-Palestine side of it. And I had lived in Iran, so I maybe that's why she accepted me, but everyone else was like on point on why they were in that group. And it was very interesting. And so I was engaging more with Jewish people in general, period, because I was in that group as well. And I kind of like would bounce off some of the ideas I was hearing from this guy on people in that group, and they would just like affirm it. And I'm like, whoa, like it was just like too much. It was too much inconsistency. This led me to, so I finished my AmeriCorps year in New York. And then after the 1 year contract, you're done. Right. And I had only planned to live in New York for 1 year. And so, I was leaving. And at that time, the guy I was seeing, I think there was like a lot of cognitive dissonance on my side, because very much pro-Palestine, and the Israeli occupation is like destroying and killing children and has been for decades. And this guy who I had such strong feelings for, and he for me was making aliyah to Israel, which means he was migrating to Israel in order to fulfill like his Jewish purpose of living in the homeland and working for, and he did that to join the Israeli Defense Force so that he could be supportive of them. And he knew Arabic so that he could help Israel. It was like, I don't know, like now looking back, like at why, there's a lot of red flags in people, right? And he was so good in some ways that I just allowed myself to like accept that he stood for something. His whole life was like, his life goals were so opposite to mine. Yeah, so it's something I worked through after that, but yeah. So anyways,
how did you get from there to humanism? So this sounds like the unraveling is taking place. Like you're tugging on that thread, everything's starting to unwind itself. So yeah, then what happens?
Yeah, so after that point, I left New York. I didn't really know where to go with myself. But I felt like I needed to start over. Like I needed another clean slate. Like I got when I was in Iran and when I was in New York. And each time I got that clean slate, I got to be whoever I wanted to be, like who I wanted. I expressed myself and people just accepted it. There was no arguing with like who I used to be. So I felt like, again, I needed a clean slate. And so I went back to Texas at the time. I had a bunch of savings, because I've always been working through college while I was in New York. And I was very good with budgeting and stuff. So, so I had some savings. So I went and stayed with my sister for a little while I like figured out what I wanted to do. And I was like, you know what? I want to, when I did my Arabic courses in, undergrad, I did 3 years of Arabic and I didn't feel like I could really speak to people in Arabic because my goal of learning Arabic was to read the Quran. To read the Quran and all of the texts, to like be able to interpret it. And it wasn't to like talk to Arabs. that wasn't it for me. And I was like, you know what? Like I was starting to see, there was so much doubt in my mind. I was still praying 5 times a day. I was still doing all of that, fasting Ramadan, all of that, still following all the rules, but I just wasn't settled like internally. And so with that feeling, I was like, I need a clean slate to just figure out who I am. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go to the Middle East and I'm going to just go practice my Arabic and travel. And that's what I'm going to do. So I wanted to go to Syria, but this was now 2012 and I wanted to go to Syria. But there was a lot of, I waited for like 3 months to book my tickets because that's when Syria started, the war in Syria started, was at that this time. It's like really bad timing. And I mean, for everyone, obviously this, I don't say that lightly, but it was when I was thinking to go, I was like, oh, like there's so much, there's a lot going on in the world. And I was trying to figure out if that was the right move. So I waited for a few months and stayed with my sister, nephews and stuff. And that was also the time where Obama was considering if he was going to do drone strikes into Syria. Mm-hmm. So it was just a lot happening and I was trying to figure out what to do. Eventually I decided to go to Lebanon, which, like it's right next door. That wasn't such a great idea, but I wanted to learn that dialect. I wanted to improve myself in that dialect specifically. And Syrian and Lebanese are pretty similar. So I was like, all right, I'm going to just go to Lebanon. I booked a one-way ticket. I got to Lebanon. And when I got there, I think I posted on Facebook and I something about arriving in Lebanon. I literally didn't know anyone. I had booked my flight and I figured out how to get from the airport to a hostel in the downtown. And I was like, okay, well, I'll figure it out, right? So I booked the hostel for like 2 weeks. And then I was like, we'll figure it out from there. I get to Lebanon, post it on Facebook. And then this young woman I had known in the seminary in Iran, she was Lebanese. And she had left the seminary after a few years. And she was back in Lebanon. And she was like, hey, like, I'm here. And like, let's meet up. I was like, okay.
Awesome. So,
yeah. So we meet up and she's like, what are you doing here? And I was like, well, I thought I'd like learn my Arabic and I don't know. Like, I'm just like wanted to travel. I wanted to see the world. And she's like, well, I've got connections with so-and-so, like I can get you into the Hausa here in Lebanon. And I was like, all right, let's do it. Cause I've got there. It's going to improve my Arabic. Right. The Hausa, the seminary in Lebanon is, especially for the women's one, is much smaller. So it's not like an enclosed campus, like the way it was in Qom. It's not like this big, huge campus. It was a building, a school building, basically, for adults. And that's pretty much what it was. So I ended up meeting people, like other Westerners, through some, like, I think it was couch surfing. The couch surfing in Lebanon used to be more of like meetup groups for international people. Whereas like in some countries, you're actually like living, like sleeping on people's couches or extra bedrooms. But in Lebanon, a lot more of it was let's meet each other. And so I met like some other people. I made this really good friend a group of friends who were like either German or one was Dutch. There were some who were from Spain and we all like spoke English, some better than others. And we decided to like travel around Lebanon on weekends together. So all of them that were there, they were there long-term for the one that I ended up rooming with. We found an apartment, a furnished apartment for 3 months. And she was there for like to also work on her Arabic, but she was in a course that her university had a connection with or something. And I didn't want to burn through my savings, so I didn't want to go to the Arabic school. I was like, I'll just go to this Hausa and I'll study Islam and learn Arabic there. I'll just like keep building on my foundation. Like, why not? Like, they're not going to charge me anything. Yeah, I'll just do that.
Did you have to start dressing more traditionally at that point again?
When I would go to the Hausa, I would wear the full thing. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. But when I was... Okay, so this is where it also becomes a little more politically complicated. The downtown, I don't know how much you know about Lebanon. It is, every Arab country is so unique in terms of their historical interactions with and reactions to colonization and the lasting effects and recent wars. And every place is so unique. And Lebanon is just as unique, if not more so. And they went through a war a couple decades before, similar to how Iran did. But it was between different factions. So the Sunnis, the Shia, and the Christians. There was a lot of Israeli support of the Christian group. So there was a lot of mistrust in general of them. And the Sunnis and the Shias were also against each other. So the city, Beirut, is literally like divided between the Christians are in this area and the Sunnis are in this area and the Shias control this area down here.
Wow.
So that's kind of how it was. And I think I was aware somewhat of all of this. I didn't realize to what extent, though. The area I was originally staying in, where the hostel was technically like a Christian area. That's where you would get like bars and stuff like that. I still wasn't drinking alcohol at this point. I was occasionally listening to music, and I don't know if I was watching TV. I don't know if that was really a big thing. This was before like streaming apps on our phones. Those didn't exist yet. It's kind of weird to say that. Like,
I know.
Like I'm old, but it was like in my 30s. Anyway, so yeah, so I meet up with her. I get the apartment in this area is called Dahi, which is an area that's controlled by Hezbollah, which is a Shia group. And they were, I don't know how much you know about like the civil rights movements in the US, but there were groups like the Black Panthers who had very like militant approaches to or reactions to the government, but mm-hmm. they would actually help the people with like everyday stuff, right?
Right.
Hezbollah acts like that in like Lebanon.
Okay.
I think that generally people think they hear Hezbollah and they're like, oh, that's some terrorist group. Mm-hmm. It's not that clear cut. It's okay. Not. It's what the Western media likes to portray in the media. There's, right. But they're more of like a security force for their people. That's okay. really what their role is. And they came out of reactions to like the war and everything. So anyways, we get this apartment. I think we found it on Craigslist. We get this apartment and it was walking distance to the Hosa. And it was like a 2-bedroom. I think I was paying like $300 a month. Lebanon is actually not that cheap compared to most of the Middle East. And there was a lot of like recent historical colonization from France. So they're a little more expensive than like Egypt, for example. So it was like kind of eating through my money at that point. I started going to the Hosa. I didn't feel like I was benefiting so much, but I also started to, I was in my off time, I was doing a lot of research in like religious. So before when I was in college, my focus was on understanding the religions and learning how the development of Christianity and Islam. But I suddenly started to think bigger and I was like, if this isn't the truth, I want to find the truth. Right. And I wasn't sure about Islam, but I wanted to understand how did all the religions develop in the first place. And so this is also when Wikipedia was only a few years old. And I used what I had available to me, but I started to learn the development of every like from the start of humanity. So I was trying to track it. This I think was before Sapiens was not on my mind. Like I didn't know of it. I hadn't heard of this book. I don't know if it was written yet. There was a lot of resources that showed up within a couple of years of me like doing this research myself. But when I say it was like hours and hours of reading, of trying to figure out and make connections between different groups of humanity, different levels of like evolution with what they believed at the time and trying to like piece those together. And then even like a year later, I came across this amazing map and I'm going to send it to you so you can include it in the show notes. This amazing map that literally shows exactly what I spent hours and hours researching. If I had just seen this, it would have been such a like time saver. But essentially what it shows is the foundation of like animism and then the result, the movement into paganism and then how monotheism starts. And you're seeing it in the entire world, like it's globally sectioned off. And you're seeing that how you're just seeing that evolution of like humanity, like because the years along with what they believed.
And fascinating.
Yeah, it was very fascinating. It's very fascinating. And I essentially did all of that legwork myself before I found this map a year later or maybe 2 years later. And so and it was like, whoa, this is exactly what I needed. Like this would have saved me so many weeks of research. But that's what I was doing. I was trying to figure out where what led to what and how did this group believe this and where did monotheism even start? Like, was it really there from the beginning? And historically speaking, there's not actually evidence of that. There's no evidence of monotheism existing. Like this idea of like Adam and Eve being in this monotheistic group. A lot of people want to talk about, is there evidence of an Adam and Eve existing? They don't want to talk about, did it even make sense for them to exist in a monotheistic perspective? Did that even make sense? And historically it doesn't, because animism and the explanation of the world around us through spirits within rocks and inanimal objects, that came with cavemen and like and the first steps up, right? Mm-hmm. Our society solidified around the as like religion started to solidify, explaining like, oh, these people in the sky, there's people in the sky who make these decisions, and then it being like, oh, there's only one person in the sky, and then understanding even in Judaism. And if you look at the Old Testament, the way it talks about God, it and like even the 10, like, what's that word?
The 10 commandments.
Yes. The 10 commandments. If you look at it, there should be no other God before me. He's mm-hmm. literally acknowledging the fact that other tribes like will worship a different God.
Mm-hmm.
It's And then you see when Moses goes up onto the mountain, and then mm-hmm. the people start worshiping a calf because they were literally Annas and pagans before, right? Yes. This idea of monotheism was created, and mm-hmm. it came from our tribe worships this God, and it's just a tribe that lasted, that just persisted.
Right.
And learning all of this stuff kind of just like blew my mind. And I'm like, what am I doing? Like, this is all just made up stuff to control control societies and mm-hmm. like push them in directions that people wanted to go. And it doesn't mm-hmm. help that, like, I'm very social justice oriented. So over the years I've learned, you know, slavery was decided, and race was decided in the US to support slavery. Like, and then Christianity was used to like support why there's this like racial component. And it's just, wow. It's just like understanding all of these ways that it's used to manipulate and control people.
Right.
And I remember the exact day I went after Hosa, I went back to my apartment, and I was sitting in my room, like on my prayer mat. And I'm just like thinking about it. Like, and I'm like, I'm still reaching out to like a God in some way. And I'm just thinking like, I want the truth. I want to know. And there's no way, like, I have no confidence now that religion in general makes sense, because it's all tools and it's all explanations. It didn't feel like truth anymore at that mm-hmm. point. Mm-hmm. And so I remember even marking down the exact day that I stopped praying. Like, it was like the midday prayer, because Shia believe that you can make up your prayers. So if you miss prayers, you can make them up, so it doesn't count against you on your, mm-hmm. your scales, right? When you get to heaven and hell. So I was like, I marked it down, and I was like, just in case I feel like I'm wrong, I can come back and make up my prayers. And I stopped praying. I wanted to see how it was going to feel. I was like, let's experiment for a week. I'm going to see how I feel if I stop praying. And I did. I stopped, and it felt very weird. It felt very uncomfortable. I felt like I was doing something wrong. And I remember there's like little habits as a practicing Muslim you develop. Every time before you eat something, you're supposed to say Bismillah, which means in the name of God. When you walk into like the bathroom, there's like a little prayer that you say, a protection prayer from like uncleanliness, right? When you walk into your home, you do it with your right foot. When you walk into like the bathroom, you do it with your left foot. Like, these little habits that just become ingrained in you. And it took me years before I even stopped thinking about it's time to pray. Mm-hmm. Like, there were years where I'd wake up and I'd be like, oh, I haven't prayed yet. And it took a long time for my body to forget the things I had drilled into myself, right. Basically. Mm-hmm. Any questions so far?
No, it's so interesting. Just an observation that sounds an awful lot to me like Orthodox Judaism, with tons and tons of rules and regulations around everything, and these habits that are become drilled into people. And you're right, I love how you said it takes our body a while to forget these habits. So yeah, very interesting. So you're still in Lebanon, you've stopped praying, you've reached the conclusion that it's all just made up in an effort to control people and to comfort people, you know, whatever things there that are going on for people. Yeah. And so you don't believe it anymore. Now what?
So now at this point, I'm still in the Hosa, and I was also living in Dahi. We had had some run-ins with Hezbollah because my roommate was Dutch and she wasn't covering. And so I'll be very brief about this part, but essentially she's Dutch. She saw this advertisement for paint that was called Dutch Boy, and she thought it was cute. She had just gotten back into Dahi, and she was walking to our apartment, and she took a picture of it. And then someone followed her back to the apartment, and like right before she's about to go in, like a van pulls up, and like they tell her to get in the van.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was traumatizing. I was in class at the time, so I was like fully covered. And when I'm walking home, she calls me and she's like, oh, Hannah, where are you? And I was like, oh, I'm just coming back from class. And she's like, okay, well, there's like two men from Hezbollah in our apartment. And so we're fast forwarding like 2 hours, essentially. And I'm like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, they want to talk to you when you get here. I can tell she's scared. And I was like, okay, like I'll be there in 10 minutes. So I get there. And there's an older gentleman with a beard and a younger one who looks like he's like fresh out of the military. And immediately, it's really interesting. Like they see me, and the older one, he's extremely respectful. He's like, oh, assalamu alaikum, sister. But, you know, how are you? We just met your roommate here. He's being very nice, very polite. The young one, he's like, they also have guns, obviously, like big machine guns. The young one is like very like firm and militant, but I can tell the older one is the one with more power in the position. And they're like, oh, we just wanted to meet you. And we just met your roommate here. And she took a picture of something. So we wanted to make sure, basically, they essentially thought she was a spy because she took this picture.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
They had taken her, they had like driven her around for like 20 minutes, took her into this like underneath a building into like a basement area, took her into a building to put her in a room by herself to interrogate her.
Terrifying.
I couldn't imagine like if I'd been in the situation. And they looked through her phone and they asked me, why'd you take this picture? And she said, I'm Dutch. And it said Dutch boy. And I liked the, you know, the picture. I thought it was cute. I was going to send it to my dad, something like that. And she's like, I'll delete the picture. I don't mind. Like, I'll delete the picture. And they're like, no, you can keep the picture. But they then look through all of the pictures. And as I was during this time period, like I had mentioned before, we were going to like visit other cities and see the touristy things around Lebanon. And when I was with this group, so I started to experiment without wearing hijab, because I had remembered that feeling when I was in Qom of feeling like the wind through my hair. But in Beirut, I was not going to take off my hijab because I knew that people are watching us. Like we're in a Hezbollah controlled area. I wasn't going to take off my hijab. So I was like, she later said to me, I was like, did you have any pictures of me in your phone? And she's like, no. Like, fortunately, this is before iPhones were even a thing. She had like a small flip phone. It wasn't like amazing pictures to begin with. Like they were very, iPhones were there, but they were still very new. She did not have an iPhone. So she didn't have any pictures of me. She had a few pictures of like places we went, like really blurry, small pictures compared to what we have now. And I was like, okay, like if they had a picture of me without hijab, like I can't imagine, because when those two guards were there, like that younger guy, he was like, she's an American. She's, you know, an American, and she's here to like spy on us. But the older guy, he's like, she's a Muslim. He asked what I was doing there. I was like, oh, I go to this Hauza. He called somebody, he verified, like literally within a minute, like I was a student there. Like it was a whole, like, they're like, oh no, she's been here for a few months. And they're asking me like, where are you from? And my friend had already taught me to not say I'm from America. She taught me to say like in Arabic, I'm Pakistani and I grew up in America. That's what she taught me to say. Don't say I'm an American, my dad's Pakistani. Okay. I'm Pakistani and I grew up in America. That's it.
I see. Yeah.
And so, and just those words like help with it. I had previously had another issue before where I was walking to class and I was talking on the phone in the streets of Beirut in English. I was talking on the phone and somebody had followed me to the Hauza, and they came in running after me. This was a man, came in running after me saying in Arabic, like, oh, she's a terrorist, she's an American, she, blah, blah, blah. And then the women at the front were like, no, she's a student here. Like, this is fine.
Oh my gosh.
It's like, yeah, there's a lot of paranoia in mm-hmm. Beirut, which is interesting because everyone wants to talk about how terrible Iranians are. But actually in Lebanon, I had far more issues. There's a lot more suspicion in Lebanon than there was in Iran.
So did you stay much longer in Lebanon after this?
Yeah, no, not much longer. So during that time, there was also a few bombings within a mile of where I lived. The war in Syria was starting to like spill over pretty much. Yeah. So it wasn't very safe. And then once I knew I didn't want to be, I was basically making that choice again that I'm no longer Muslim. And I didn't really know what that meant exactly. But I was like, I'm no longer Muslim. And I didn't want to stay there anymore. I was also kind of scared, like if they find out that I don't wear hijab, then what's going to happen to me, basically. Right. So I booked a flight to Cairo. I just looked up where can I go that I don't need to apply for a visa. And I got a one-way ticket to Cairo. And there were some people I had met in the couch surfing group who knew people in Cairo that had hosted them. That's an even longer story, but it wasn't actually such a safe environment that I went into. But it was just one particular person, found out he was like, had hidden cameras and stuff. And it was a whole crazy thing. But, there were some people I knew that helped me to like, at least get to Cairo. And so once I got there, literally, like when we landed, I didn't even take it off on the plane. When we landed, then I took off my hijab, because I was like, oh, I don't want the couch surfing people to see me with hijab, but I also don't want, someone in Lebanon to like see me without hijab. Mm-hmm. So I waited until I got to Cairo, and that's really where it was my new fresh start, because I wasn't wearing a hijab. I didn't tell anybody I had been Muslim. So from everyone's perspective, I'm just some like mixed race kid from the US, right? Like they didn't know anything about who I was. And that's where I started to being able to say that, oh, I like no one would ask you about your religion. And in Egypt, it's very different. Like they love Americans. Everyone wants to like have sex with you or hang out with you. That's pretty much depending on the gender. Yeah, so that's where I first started to explore with dating. That's really where I started to explore with dating and exploring who I was, like sexuality and everything like that. Not in terms of like other women, but because that's still pretty unsafe to do in the Middle East, or it was at least. But like with dating and like figuring out, like taking steps like that. Any questions on that so far?
How long did you stay in Egypt then? We'll just start landing this plane towards what's going on with you in the United States now.
Yeah. Okay. So I was originally just going to travel for a few months and I hadn't heard of humanism yet. I was really of just like organized religion is bullshit. Like I'm out kind of thing. So nobody knew in the US that I'd stopped wearing hijab. I was only going to be there for a few months and then I was going to backpack through Africa. But then I met somebody there and then I ended up staying for like 9 months, I think. And I had been in Lebanon for a few months. So this is now like more than a year that I've like, since I've left the US. And when I was there, there's not more like interpersonal stuff that's not related to like humanism and religion and belief. So I stayed there for a while because of a guy. And I didn't exactly have something waiting for me back home. It was just like what I'm doing with my life. And then I got a job offer from someone who knew me when I was in AmeriCorps, like back in New York. So I took the job. I went back to New York for a few months. And then this guy in Egypt was like, I miss you. I want to get married. I want to marry you. Like, please come back and then we'll figure out whatever, whatever. And I was like, well, I'm only going to come back if you'll get a visa to the US. And that's a whole nother long story. But a year or so later, he was somebody who worked for the United Nations. He was an interpreter. So his English was amazing. And what's funny is that in Egypt, people would think I was the Egyptian and he was the American. it was very, because his accent was like on point. He worked for the UN and then at some point he got, a visa. So I was there in total, like a year and a half. And he got a visa to New York. Like that's where the UN headquarters is. So he got the job, very intelligent person. And, he's a narcissist, but he was an intelligent person otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so we came back to New York. I got involved with Muslimish for a while. I won't go into too much about them, but I was again looking for community. So I had gone to one Muslimish event when my first year in New York. but the founder, he's well known to be a little, I don't know how to say it. He's a bit aggressive. He's okay. Aggressive, militant in terms of how he approaches like leaving religion. And so at the time I was like, this isn't it. Like, I'm not coming back here. And so then a couple years later, I was like, okay, why not? Like, why don't I try again? He's still militant, but we became friends. And
Muslimish is a humanist group.
No.
Okay.
No, what they're
is,
not.
Okay. All right.
No. Muslimish is, I don't know their exact mission because they weren't very mission oriented. Okay. They're basically a group for people who are on the spectrum from like leaving religion to being militant ex-Muslim atheists.
Okay.
Most of the board at that time was militant ex-Muslim atheists.
I see.
Not humanists. And I didn't even know what humanism really was at that point. There were a lot of people who would come to the meetups who were kind of like me, like recently not religious. Everyone has their own journeys. Like everyone has their own stuff, but it wasn't, there was a lot of, anyway, so I became involved in the group, and because I was very active and like a little social butterfly, I very soon became like the organizer of events in New York City. Mm-hmm. And then after being on the board for a while and being the organizer, it was time for like for elections for the board. And so I had become very close with some of the people on the board. There were a couple of the women that we had a really good dynamic. And I got voted in to be president. And I was also first convinced to run for president. And then I did. And then I got the position. And there was a lot of restructuring because meetings were not very efficient. We weren't really moving forward. So at Muslimish, there was this vision to, there was like meetups to just like talk. And then the founders really wanted to be able to have conferences. Like their big thing was conferences with speakers and stuff like that. So they were doing that. It wasn't really about building community. It was about building a network base, if mm-hmm. anything. And there would just be meetups and we would just like talk at these meetups. So while I was there, I became president. The old VP stepped down to become VP, or she was voted for that. She wanted to step away from being president anyway. And that's Noura. And then one on the same board was Janan, who is, I think she was maybe historian at the time, or she was in charge of like, I don't know. She was more of a, she gave a lot of, she had a lot of connections and she gave a lot of advice on cultural group, like okay. events. And she's a very academic, she has a very good academic background. And she's humanist, and she was when we came into this. So she was sort of the humanist connection, actually. The first person I really knew who talked about humanism. And she was trying to steer, I don't know if intentionally or deliberately, but she was trying to steer Muslimish in being a humanist organization. I was trying to steer the organization in being more organized and a safer space. And we had a lot of differences with the founders, basically. So after being president for a while, and we put on some conferences, we moved into Boston. That I think in 1 year, we had a conference in New York, in Boston, and in Detroit within a year.
Wow.
Yeah. And we built the bases from scratch, like in Boston, and built it up in Detroit. And one of the founders lived in Detroit, so he was doing a lot of that work. But I think it meant a lot to have like women leaders in this organization. But to be blunt, it wasn't, at the end of the day, the founders wanted to have the final say, and we had some differences in how we wanted to look at what's the purpose of this organization, and making especially women feel safe in this organization, which there were some issues that came up. So mm-hmm. that sort of led to me, Noura, Janan leaving the board, along with another woman who was an organizer in Detroit. And basically 80% of the female membership, active female membership at that time, they all left with us when we started mm-hmm. NAS. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk bad about another mm-hmm. organization, but mm-hmm. I will say that I don't feel that it's a safe space for women, basically. Okay. So I wouldn't advise any women to go there for the right. Maybe that's changed over the years, but that's the situation it was in. And I don't think there's been any room. There was no desire at the time to change anything. And so I don't see that changing now.
But, you were interested in a more democratic kind of group. As well,
not just that. We wanted it to be community based. We wanted like the whole idea was that we're doing this to build a community, mm-hmm. And also we wanted it to have a social justice element. And what we started to see, and we don't have members like this in NAS, is anyone who has a militant extremist perspective of any kind, and that includes being an atheist too, because that can also be just as harmful. Or it can be harmful in other ways as an extremist Muslim can be to people. And so we wanted people who could come and discuss ideas, talk about ideas, grow as people, grow as a group, have people there to support each other, everything that a community offers people. And that's what we wanted to build. And we use humanism as that basis with looking at, okay, we can be good without God. We don't need organized religion to tell us to be good people. We have a duty as human beings to be good to each other. We want a functioning society. And so we should create a functioning society and be active members of that functioning society. And that's what we wanted to do. And a lot of people who left with us at that time had a similar vision about wanting a community, wanting safe spaces. It's totally fine if people date each other in the group, but we accept members who are not, that's not why they're getting into the group. They're not looking to like hook up with people. They're right. looking for building a community space. And so that's what we started to build within S. And I think this was a big debate within like the first year, even for me personally, after starting in NAS, maybe not the first year, maybe a few months, the year of transition from Muslimish into NAS, that I didn't like using the word humanist because I didn't want to label myself. And I was very adamantly against calling myself anything for a while. And at some point I was like trying to describe myself. I'm like, okay, description wise, I went with cultural Muslim for a while. And I was like, I don't think that's enough because culturally I have some relevance, but it's not that I don't believe either. And a lot of people call themselves a cultural Muslim, still have an element of belief. And I didn't have that period. Eventually I wanted to call myself a secular Muslim. That took some adjustment because I liked the word, what secular meant, but it felt like a dirty word. Like calling myself secular, it felt dirty. Like,
right.
Yeah. Like, you know, when sometimes women will embrace the word slut for themselves, like somebody who's like, you know, they're out there sexually and they're proud of it, and they'll call themselves a slut in a way that's like self-empowering. But it still felt dirty in the same way, like calling myself a slut would feel dirty. It took me a while to overcome that. And there was nothing logically that made sense. Why would I feel this way? But eventually I went on to call myself secular Muslim because I felt like it brought together those elements. And then as I learned more about humanism, I was like, there's no controlling here. There's no dogma that we're, you know, there's no books that we all have to follow. It's just about being a good ethical person. And that aligns with who I want to be and who I am now. So then I eventually added on humanist there, you know, secular Muslim humanist. So that's sort of how it happened.
Wow. And so now you are, I don't know how ANAS functions. Is there a president and a board?
Yeah. So I'm the president. We kind of decided together what the roles would be. I didn't assume I was going to be president, but we each like kind of do what's in our skill set. So we also open like board members to attend meetings if they want to. They're not always publicized because it's sometimes it's just like, oh, what works with your schedule works with your schedule kind of stuff. In the early times, we also had a couple members, board members who eventually moved to Palestine. So that they're not as active now, but they're still technically part of the board. And so we are very much more democratically based. Like when we do events and meetups, it's very much like, are you people interested in this or should we do this instead? What time works best for people? And then it's publicized to like any of our less active members or people want to bring a friend who's related, who might connect with the group, then they're allowed to like come to most of the events.
And what's the main purpose? You've mentioned community several times. So is it for people who have come out of Muslim backgrounds who have embraced humanism and just building a community where they can feel comfortable and safe?
Well, kind of. Our tagline is humanists rising from Muslim communities, but we are not that prescriptive with it. Most people who join don't identify as a humanist, but when they read our values, then they're like, oh, I identify with this. And that's what it's about. It's not about, do you call yourself a humanist? It's, are you in alignment with these values and this lifestyle of being good people and being together?
Beautiful.
And a big part of it is just creating this alternative space for people who want community, but they don't want to be a part of their religion anymore. And, you know, people don't feel comfortable at the mosque because of their beliefs, but they still want the community that you would find at a mosque. And that's the purpose. We don't have a political agenda. I think that the other ex-Muslim groups they got a handle on that. So it's really about the next stage. Like once we do have people who have recently left religion, we have people who were raised in like kind of with one atheist parent, one Muslim parent, like usually from a Muslim background anyway, but people who have always been kind of secular or people who are from very insular communities. It's pretty mixed, like what brings people in, but the shared connection is, do we have similar values? We don't accept people who are Islamophobic or racist or ageist or any of these negative bad things. You know, we want people who have progressive values and just want to be around each other and learn from each other, grow together.
Beautiful. Yeah. I love that. That sounds like such a wonderful community. And your story has just been fascinating. I hope you write a book. Because I would read that book or watch the movie.
That.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And so how can people find you online or find your group?
Yeah, you can find us on Meetup if you're in New York City, or our website, which is an-nas.org. And if you want to join, there's like a link, you know, join us here. And Nura, our vice president / chair of membership, then she would schedule an interview with you. And it's a very low key. It's more like, tell us about you and tell us like why you're interested in being part of this community. Just, mm-hmm. you know, make sure we're all on the same page. And then we sometimes will get people who are more on the Muslim side a little bit. If they're too much on the Muslim side, then we might say, I don't know if we're the right organization for you. And we're just looking for people with like, you know, positive or like similar vibes as each other, like same values and that kind of stuff. So
wow, how exciting. Boy, I can't wait to see what the next 10 years of your life holds, because the last 10 years have been pretty incredible. Thank you so much for joining me today, Hannah. It was really a pleasure. And I'm looking forward to getting to meet you in person through the fellowship sometime soon. And I will include the links, and you're going to send me a link of the map, the very interesting map that you have.
I'm going to send it to you.
And thank you so much. It was a real delight getting to know you better.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for having me. And I hope if anyone out there is listening and you think that this sounds like the group for you, then please reach out.
Excellent. Thanks, everyone, for joining us again for the conclusion of my chat with Hannah Abbasi. And I look forward to seeing you all again soon. And take care. Thanks again, Hannah.
Bye.